I have some considerable pleasure in lecturing on the topic of sin at Cornell because it isn't often done. Although I do it with a little trepidation, over breakfast I asked my wife and her caregiver, Marcia, if they'd like to come along as examples of sinners, but they declined and said that I'd do very well myself, which I couldn't really argue with. But it is an interesting and important topic, one not often discussed in the modern university. I think I already told the story, didn't I, of David and Bathsheba? I have it in my notes here, but I think I talked about it in an earlier lecture. It's a wonderful story and relevant to the topic here because it was one of the first historical examples that we have on record where, in this case, Nathan the prophet was able to confront David the king with his misdeed because of the fact that Nathan knew that David knew that he stood under the judgment of God, that Uriah the Hittite, even as a foreigner, even as a resident alien, was protected by the Jewish code and by God's presence in Israel, so that David knew he was responsible and had to act responsibly. That is a great moment in the development of Western culture, and it clearly is related to the pervasive, persistent interest that Jews through the centuries have had in justice. Jews, perhaps as much as any people on the planet, have been concerned to talk about issues of justice, and I think part of this goes all the way back to that kind of incident with David and Uriah the Hittite. The term sin is almost never heard in the modern secular university, except when talking about what religious people believe. It says a great deal about the ideological commitments of the modern university. The language that is used commonly by tens of millions of Americans to describe their own lives and experience is simply excluded from the dialogue. If you go to all kinds of churches and if you mix with all kinds of people, the term sin is a common term. And it has become a very difficult term for many 20 and 21st century Americans to get hold of. I think in part this is because we come at the term from so many different perspectives. To take an extreme case, for someone who shares a totally deterministic view like that of my friend and esteemed colleague Will Provine, sin, and I'm not sure he would want to use the term really at all, would be at most something like a glitch or malfunction in a computer, something in our brain circuits that wasn't operating properly. Now, most atheists are not determinists in the sense that Will Provine is. I think Will is fairly consistent at this point, and we've from time to time over the years debated each other in class on these issues. Will sees humans basically as sophisticated machines, and within that kind of a framework, what does sin mean? It means like some kind of a computer glitch, some bleeding of electricity maybe from one neural circuit to the other, some different sort of biochemical activity. On the other hand, many humanists tend to view sin, again, they would not use the term as such, as that which grows out of ignorance and the lack of enlightenment. Or they speak in terms of a child having grown up in a poor environment. We make mistakes or bad judgments when we lack information or knowledge or human wisdom. Or we are simply acting on the basis of bad things that have been done to us. And within such a framework, the remedy for sin is more and better research and education, or more government programs to improve the environment in which children grow up. The classical Marxist views, on the other hand, classical Marxist views the human predicament in terms of economic realities, in terms of the social and economic and political oppression of those who control the means of production. All of these views, I think, have some validity. I think clearly there is such a thing as economic oppression. Clearly there are kids who grow up in bad environments, and this has a major impact on how they lead their lives. Romantics, rebelling against the excessive rationalism of the 18th century, believed that some kind of a return to nature, to simpler and more primitive ways of living, would enable us to flourish as human beings. They used terms like the simple life and the noble savage, and civilization is too much with us. If we do not use the term sin, we typically use similar or analogous terms to describe what we think of as wrong or problematic in human existence, in our own lives and in the lives of others. We think and talk about what needs changing in our own lives and in the world about us. We talk about what such change might look like. Whatever term or terms we use are dependent on our larger or overall view of the nature of the world about us and who we are as human beings, whether God exists as not or not, and so on. Whether or not we use the term sin is connected with how we view human responsibility. When and to what degree are we responsible for our own actions? When and to what degree do we hold others responsible for their actions? To whom or to what are we and others responsible? These are basic human questions. They're basic questions that affect us every day of our lives in terms of reacting to other people, in terms of how the judicial system is set up, when a degree of leniency seems warranted in a particular criminal case, and so on. We face a kind of paradox at this point. On the one hand, it seems to be kinder and more compassionate to excuse the sinful or antisocial actions of others or of ourselves, particularly in those cases when we can point to extenuating circumstances or environmental factors that help explain these actions. We use phrases like, she wasn't really herself when she did that, or he came out of a very difficult background. He was in a state of shock from the loss of a son or daughter in an automobile accident. Perhaps he or she was seriously ill or was drunk or had been using drugs. Or sometimes we point to social and economic factors. She grew up in a very poor home. He grew up in a crime-infested ghetto, was abused as a child, and so on. And all of that makes sense to us. All of these do seem to be factors that influence our behavior as human beings. But on the other hand, when we refuse to hold another human being personally accountable for her actions, we dehumanize her. We begin to treat her as an object or as a machine. If you simply treat the other person as if they had no choice, as if they have no responsibility for their actions, they're simply a product of their environment and their genetic endowment, I would suggest that in a very serious way, that really dehumanizes the other person. It treats the other person as less than human, because human beings almost always, except in extreme cases, have some degree of choice about the situations in which they live out their lives. We have incredible literature on this, even from extreme situations like the Russian gulags and the Nazi death camps. I gave a seminar one semester on literature that had been written by prisoners, people who had been prisoners in the death camps and in the gulags and survived. And one of the amazing things growing out of that seminar was this strong, strong realization that even in those extreme circumstances, people came to understand, or some did, that they still had a degree of freedom to structure their lives and to either accept to some degree or constantly fight what was happening to them. As I've already in part mentioned in a previous lecture, it is for this reason, that is, that we can dehumanize a person by not holding them accountable at all, that I believe that some of the worst racism in America today is the racism of the white liberal or of some black leaders who constantly portray blacks in America, mainly in terms of their being victims. I think when that is pushed too far, it's incredibly dehumanizing because it treats the other person just as a victim, just as a machine, just as at the mercy of other people's actions. Obviously, certainly whites have badly victimized blacks, and they still victimize blacks in many different situations. But to treat other persons only or even mainly as victims is to refuse to treat them as equals. And that is an incredibly important point ethically. If a person is senile, if it's a child or an infant, if it's a person with severe brain damage, we patronize them to some extent. We humor them. I realized when my dad lived with us for 5 years, between the ages of 90 and 95, there were some points as his brain began to deteriorate where it was utterly fruitless to argue with him. You would try your best to distract him, and I've seen that in other cases. But to treat a person who is not senile, not an infant, not brain damaged in that way, it seems to me is a very, very serious form of discrimination, and it is to patronize the other person. And there are no algorithms, no clear formulae, no exact rules for how you do this. This is one of the perennial human dilemmas. When do we hold our friends, our spouses, our children, others accountable for their actions? And when do we sort of give them the benefit of the doubt because of environmental circumstances? And I think I, for one, have made mistakes on both sides of the equation. I think I have hurt certain people very close to me because I didn't sufficiently take into account their background, their experiences, and so on. And in other cases, I think I've hurt people very badly who were close to me because I patronized them and did not hold them accountable when they actually did have the possibility of acting more responsibly. These are difficult issues, and there are no simple answers to them. Now, I want to give just a little bit of a running commentary on the Niebuhr reading that we will be reading this week and next. Niebuhr was one of the premier American theologians. He had a profound effect on the theological thinking in America during the 30s, 40s, 50s, and since then, and also on social scientists and others who read his work. He's widely quoted to this day. He writes in what today seems like a somewhat strident form. Some of you may find this irritating at times, but he was a remarkably astute and fruitful thinker who had a great deal of influence on how we see ourselves in the modern world. Let me just give you a little sort of brief model of sorts of how Niebuhr analyzed the human situation. He saw human beings as finite, as mortal, as limited, people who will die someday, people who do not have full control over their circumstances. And this, I think, is obvious to all of us. We may be killed by an automobile accident, plague. We may have a great financial hardship because of what happens in the stock market, and so on. And these factors here mean that we are insecure. Again, I think not at all controversial. This is just part of the human condition. To be a human is not to be a god, and it means that we are subject to all the ordinary vicissitudes of life, the uncertainties. Some of us are born with physical limitations, with genes that predispose us to diabetes. Some of us are born less intelligent and more intelligent, physically stronger, weaker, all kinds of limitations, and this makes us insecure. Now, Niebuhr points out that the same applies to animals other than humans. Animals also are limited and mortal and finite, and they're also insecure. But there's something that distinguishes humans from animals in that humans experience anxiety because of their freedom or their ability to transcend themselves and think about their situation. Self-transcendence. Animals, from what we know, although there may be some borderline cases in gorillas or chimpanzees and so on, but for the most part, there's virtually no evidence that animals think about how they're doing. One of the characteristics of the human being, and I've noted this already in a previous lecture, is that part of yourself can stand outside the rest of yourself and ask, how am I doing? How ought I to live? What ought I to do in this situation? Or what's going to happen if the market doesn't come up again? Or what's going to happen if it turns out I'm pregnant or I lose my job? Animals don't seem to move into the future like this or to worry about the past in the same way. They seem to be much more, as far as we can tell, much more like very young children with more of a sense of the immediate future. And it's because, let me change this a little bit here. I think it'll be clearer if I take anxiety out of here, and this is not a very elegant model, put these here, and these lead to anxiety. That is, it's our finitude that makes us insecure, but it's our ability, our freedom to transcend ourselves and to think about these realities that makes us anxious. And animals don't seem to get anxious in the way that humans do. We can make animals neurotic, in quotes, or anxious by maltreating them badly, and there are borderline cases where it looks like they might be anxious, but most ethologists, most people who really study animal behavior closely, ethologists and others, don't think that animals are able to transcend themselves in the way that humans are, and thus don't become anxious as a result of their insecurity. But we possess a degree of freedom and the possibility of self-transcendence. We become anxious. Niebuhr writes, anxiety is the inevitable concomitant of the paradox of freedom and finiteness in which man is involved. And he writes, anxiety is the precondition of sin. Anxiety is the precondition of sin. He always sees two possibilities growing out of the anxiety. One, the ideal possibility, he's writing now as a Christian, Jews would believe roughly the same thing, the ideal possibility would be to trust God for the future, for one's needs in the difficult situation, the possibility that frequently happens to us, he notes, is that we don't trust God, but that we try to secure our own future. He says the ideal possibility is that faith in the ultimate security of God's love would overcome all immediate insecurities of nature and history. That is why Niebuhr explains, quote, "Christian orthodoxy has consistently defined unbelief as the root of sin, or as the sin which precedes pride. But when we fail to trust God," Niebuhr argues, "we typically attempt to secure our future on our own, and that would be the other possibility here, our future on our own. And this usually takes the form of a quest for power, a quest for possessions, a quest for fame, a pretension that we're really not as ignorant and finite and limited as we really are, and so on. Yes, it's true in part. The rich are more secure in some ways than the poor. The rich often can eat better, have better shelter and clothing, have better medical care. So it looks as if we can just become rich, we would be more secure. If we could just get more power over other people and over nature. If we could become famous, I think in university settings, I've often pondered what would happen if it were a requirement that we did all our publishing anonymously. I don't think the rate of publishing would stay at the same level it is. I think vacations in the Caribbean or skiing at Aspen would look considerably more attractive if we had to publish anonymously. So the quest for fame is one of the ways in which we try to hide our insecurity. He says, or we can try to secure our future ourselves almost always at the expense of others, at the expense of other people or of nature. We become involved in injustice. We oppress other people and cruelly exploit nature because of our anxiety that grows out of our insecurity and because of our failure, says Niebuhr, to trust God for the future. He says that all human life is involved in the sin of seeking security at the expense of other life. All human life is involved in the sin of seeking security at the expense of other life. Anxiety, he argues, is not just the precondition of sin. On the other hand, to some degree, it is a source of human creativity, somewhat in the sense of necessity being the mother of invention. And I add this parenthetically, I think Niebuhr stresses that point too much, that is the relationship between anxiety and creativity. But I don't think this is a critical flaw in his argument. I think it's just a detail. That is, my own position is that I think that much creativity grows out of human security and playfulness in a sense of the goodness and beauty of life. Anxiety, I think, is just one source of creativity, but by no means the only one. But again, that's just a detail, not a critical issue. Niebuhr deals at length with what he calls the sin of pride. He notes, correctly, I think, that, quote, "biblical and Christian thought has maintained with a fair degree of consistency that pride is more basic in human beings than sensuality, and that the latter is in some way derived from the former." He speaks of the pride of power, for instance. The first form of the pride of power is seen in those individuals and groups in society whose position appears to be secure. He writes this. He says, "The human ego assumes its self-sufficiency and self-mastery and imagines itself secure against all vicissitudes. It does not recognize the contingent and dependent character of its life and believes itself to be the author of its own existence, the judge of its own values, and the master of its own destiny." The pride of power of the rich, he refers to, who think themselves secure but do not realize how fleeting is their power and how precarious their security. He says that human ambitions know no limits. Even with great power, we may still perceive ourselves to be insecure. And in some ways, we indeed are insecure. And that's why in many people, some of the most insecure people I have known have been very famous, have been very rich, and so on, because their very quest for fame and material possessions and so on was a way to deal with their insecurity, but not necessarily a very successful way. I think societally it's very, very clear that in symbols like the hydrogen bomb and weapons of mass destruction, our very quest for security becomes the very thing in a way that frightens us the most. The second form of the pride of power is the pride of power of those who are insecure. He says this is the sin of the advancing forces of society in distinction to the established forces. Poverty, he writes, is a peril to the wealthy, but not to the poor. Niebuhr has some wonderful, wonderful quotes. Poverty is a peril to the wealthy, but not to the poor. But the poor often desire what they do not have, sometimes with great passion and sometimes compulsively. Sometimes we try to conquer nature, get more power over nature to make ourselves more secure. Greed, according to Niebuhr, quote, is in short the expression of man's inordinate ambition to hide his insecurity in nature, that is, in the world about us. Why are we greedy? In most cases, we're greedy because we're insecure. I think I used the example before. We don't go around wildly grasping for air and stuff it into plastic bags. And in this part of the world, we don't do that with water and so on because there's plenty of it. We become greedy when we sense we're insecure and we need more. Greed, he writes, has become the besetting sin of a bourgeois culture. This culture is constantly tempted to regard physical comfort and security as life's final good, and to hope for its attainment to a degree which is beyond human possibilities. The will to power, in other words, quote, involves the ego in injustice. It seeks, and I'm quoting Niebuhr, a security beyond the limits of human finiteness, and this inordinate ambition arouses fears and enmities which the world of pure nature, with its competing impulses of survival, does not know. He refers next to intellectual pride. He sees this as a more spiritual sublimation of the pride of power. He uses terms like, quote, the ideological taint. He says we pretend to have achieved a degree of knowledge which is beyond the limit of finite life. All knowledge, according to Niebuhr, is tainted with an ideological taint. It pretends to be more true than it is. It is finite knowledge gained from a particular perspective, but it pretends to be final and ultimate knowledge. This clearly is one of the besetting sins of the academy. Ideally, when we've worked 20 years supporting a specific theory or research project, and a colleague comes along with decisive proof that we got it wrong, we ought to say, thank you very much. This is wonderful to know that it really isn't the way I thought. It's different, and I thank you for pointing this out. But we don't do that too graciously. If we do it at all, because so much of our personal ego is tied up in our research and in what we claim to know. I've been lucky over the years. I've had TAs who have very kindly and graciously pointed out to me rather frequently when they thought I was wrong, when they thought my ideas didn't hold up well. And that's really wonderful, even though sometimes it hurts a bit. In fact, I require them to do this. I say that's what I expect of them. And ultimately, I think that's the way we learn. We'll be looking at some animal rights theorists in a week or two. And I think one of the real problems we will see with people like Peter Singer and Tom Regan is that I think they pretend to a certainty which they simply do not possess. I think they pretend to a kind of intellectual clarity which in part results from the fact that they hide the fact of their basic assumptions. And once you begin to unpack those basic assumptions, it becomes much clearer that their position is one possible position, but by no means the only possible position. Niebuhr writes that the philosopher who imagines himself capable of stating a final truth merely because he has sufficient perspective upon past history to be able to detect previous philosophical errors is clearly the victim of the ignorance of his own ignorance. Standing on a high pinnacle of history, he forgets that this pinnacle also has a particular locus, and that his perspective will seem as partial to posterity as the pathetic parochialism of previous thinkers. This sounds like Niebuhr is a relativist. He's not. He's very much closer to what Alan Wood calls a fallibilist. He recognizes that all human knowledge and all human research programs are subject to error, that our knowledge claims are fallible. They always may be mistaken. These statements of Niebuhr's are almost prophetic in one sense. They are very similar to some of the beliefs of today's postmodernists, but they were penned over 50 years ago. He writes that not the least pathetic is the certainty of a naturalist age, naturalistic age, that its philosophy is a final philosophy because it rests upon science, a certainty which betrays ignorance of its own prejudices and failure to recognize the limits of scientific knowledge. Question.
I'm a little confused.
Nice and loud, please.
I'm a little confused because doesn't faith require more certainty than, say, evidence?
Doesn't faith require more certainty?
Than science? Isn't science kind of based on the idea that we can't really claim that we know anything?
We often juxtapose faith and reason. I would say that that contrast is often not helpful because all of reason rests on certain initial faith commitments or assumptions, and faith is always informed by reason. There's a kind of circularity. I think where we go wrong is this. Believing Jews and Christians, Muslims, other religious people, as well as Marxists and others, I think often continue to have, and in some cases almost everyone has periods where they have doubts, where faith is not certainty by any means, where they wonder in the midst of incredible suffering, let's say, your family is killed by a drunk driver or something. You know, does God really exist? What's going on? Faith, as I see it, is not what I would call theoretical certainty. Faith in the biblical worldview is more like the willingness to bet your life on something. It's closer to obedience. It's closer to saying, you know, I don't have all the answers. I'm not theoretically certain God is even there, but I'm going to stake my life on this. I'm going to really bet on this. Now, it's much more complex than that because Christians and others believe then there is an internal witness of the Holy Spirit and so on and so on. But no, I don't think in most cases faith is what I would call certainty. Faith, as Pascal and others realized, is a kind of wager, a kind of risk. But it's more than that. As Kierkegaard and others recognize, it's not just an intellectual assent, it's betting your life on something. It's the willingness, as Niebuhr would see it, to give up the worship of yourself and your own interests and center your life in God. Any thoughts on that? Can anyone help me with that? That's not an extremely illuminating answer. Does that help at all, or do you want to?
Doesn't to define.
Nice and loud, so they can hear in back.
To define what it is that you're basing your life upon, instead of saying, I don't know, that it's a mysterious eye rather than a certain figure, a certain idol that you're basing your life upon. Isn't that more insecure than to say that you are ultimately don't know what your life is about?
I think it would be, except. Christians, Jews, and others believe that God is a gracious God who then gives us certain experiences and evidences of his presence. The whole experience of forgiveness, the experience of grace, the experience of life as a gift, as Hauerwas talks about, all of these would tend to be a kind of confirmation of that leap of faith. So I think it's not quite the way you put it, although I think there is never a point where the believer somehow controls the situation. There's always an element, it seems to me, of risk, always an element of uncertainty in the life of faith. And it's ultimately the kind of dynamic that we see at the crucifixion of Jesus when he says, O God, into thy hands I commend my spirit. The believer, in this sense, simply says, I don't have the ultimate answers, but I believe God is, and that he enters into relationship with those who seek him, and so on. So there is an element of risk. It's never something that we control. Yes.
I would add that while there always is some sense of insecurity because we are human, but that the trust that that Christians place in God to take care of everything overcomes that insecurity.
I think that's right, and I think this is that's very well put, and this is why often in the midst of incredible pain and suffering in the gulags, look at some of Solzhenitsyn stuff, look at some of the death camp literature, there can be an inner peace that one has that grows out of that trust. I think that's exactly right. Chloe?
I was thinking that the comparison being made between faith and science, I don't feel that there's such a giant difference between the way scientists and theologians or people who have a religious belief go about making their conclusions. In science, you conduct an experiment or you do a naturalistic observation of some sort, and from that observation you draw a conclusion about the way the world works. And in most faith religions, you look at history as an observation, and from that observation you make a conclusion. As we were talking about last time, about the stories that get passed down, those were the observations, and those observations get passed down from generation to generation, so that the children understand why they have made these conclusions about how the world works and who God is because of the historical observations that have been.
No, that's extremely helpful. I think something like that indeed is what happens. And I think also the real contrast is not between religion and science. The real contrast, I think that's not a fruitful contrast. The contrast is between religious belief and other philosophical belief. The belief that nothing exists but mass, energy, and causality, the belief of the atheist or the philosophical materialist, is not a scientific belief. This is a very, very important distinction. Scientists have to be methodological naturalists. That is, the way science, modern science, works. You investigate phenomena as if there is nothing going on but mass, energy, and causality, which you can quantify and observe and so on. But science does not demand that you become a metaphysical naturalist. That is, that you become an atheist. It couldn't have demanded that, because virtually all of the early scientists in the modern period were Christians. So science entails a methodological naturalism, but not a metaphysical naturalism. So the contrast, then, is really not between faith and science or religion and science. It's between, say, the faith of the Christian or the Jew or someone else and the faith of the atheist, because atheists also have a kind of faith. Their faith is they're staking their lives, they're living their lives on the principle that God does not exist. And they believe there's certain evidence for that and certain reasons for believing that. But that, again, you can't prove. So in both cases, people have faith. It's just that the object of faith, the particular beliefs and the commitment and so on, is different. A lot of us, in fairly simple terms, our ultimate commitment is to ourselves. We're really egoists. We're hedonistic egoists who really live out our lives as if each of us is a god. And, of course, that's where traditional Jewish faith and Christian faith and Muslim faith and so on says that's idolatrous. As Iris Murdoch puts it, the self is too small and uninteresting an object to deserve all the attention we give it. So in a way, many people's faith is neither a kind of atheistic belief or a kind of theistic belief. It's simply in the rightness of living as if you're God, as if I'm the center of everything and other people have to conform to my intentions and my desires and so on. Did you want to come back on that? Was that helpful at all, or are we still... No, actually, if you you'll see this as you read the text, and I can read that again. His complaint is clearly not against science. Not against science, nor is my complaint ever against science as such. It's against a kind of false confidence in science. It's the complaint against those who think that science and technology can solve all of our problems as human beings, that it's science and education that will do it. And to a large degree, that is the functional religion of the modern university. And one of the reasons places like Cornell exclude normative Christianity and so on is they don't want any competitors. The functional religion of most modern secular universities is a kind of faith in science, technology, and education, and a kind of very, very strong emphasis on human fulfillment as the summum bonum, as the highest good. Thank you. These have been, ouch. I might as well leave my notes for a minute. Any last, this happens too often. But those were extremely helpful comments and a very, very helpful question. Any last thoughts or comments or questions? Yes, Edwina? Nice and loud, please. Well, I think it's hard in some ways to face head on the fact that you're going to die. You're all dying already. All of us are dying right now. As I said, pardon?
I'm not dying.
Yes. No, you are. The parts of your body are dying, and you've already died to certain possibilities that you might have had. Pardon? That you might have had 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I use the example of... let me stop here. We need to. I'm going to lose this one. Here we go.